Ever notice how the most fascinating stories are never really about what happened, but why it happened? The cultural undercurrents, the power moves, the moments that shift everything? That's where Claude, an AI thinking partner, comes in. For minds that see a headline and ask, what does this really mean? And who's actually behind this? Claude helps you dig deeper into the questions that won't let you go, connecting dots others might miss. Try Claude for free at claude.ai/morningmeeting. Saturday. It's October 4th, 2025, and you are listening to Morning Meeting. I'm Ashley Baker in London.
And I'm Michael Haney in New York City.
And what a week it's been in the news. Well, in the United States, Trump seems to be pursuing a partisan military, and he wants to use our cities as a training ground for them. But we don't have the heart to ruin your day. Instead, let's talk about another piece of news. Researchers at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology have examined more than 1,100 species of mammals and birds to investigate a very simple question. Which sex tends to live longer? They concluded after much research and in no uncertain terms that it's females, but the rationale behind it was very surprising. It turns out that the mating rituals of men are largely responsible for their shorter lives. So the more vigorous and hectic those are, the worse for longevity. The whole shebang just requires so much energy. So Elon Musk, Boris Johnson, and the rest of you lot, consider yourself warned. As usual, airmail is the antidote to everything bad happening in the world, and we have a great episode and issue for you.
Yeah, you've got a great issue today. First, 2 years ago, a woman named Abby Choi, a 28-year-old aspiring fashion influencer and mother of four, was murdered in Hong Kong. At the time, her death was believed to be part of a plot to gain control of her fortune. This week, our writer Eric Wilson, who has been covering the case, joins us with troubling new details that have emerged. Then, it's fall, the season of the old college try, and this week, our colleague Clara Malow has the wild tale of a woman who gave the old college try at concealing her identity in order to get into an Ivy League school, and what happened to her when she succeeded. And finally, so many of you who love airmail also love great books, and we have some very good news here to announce. This week, we are awarding the first airmail literary prizes presented by Mont Blanc, officially named the Tom Wolfe Literary Prizes in honor of the journalist and novelist. We're awarding one for fiction and one for reportage, and two of the individuals who helped select the honorees for the awards, our colleague Julie Vitale, along with Alexander Wolf Schiff, will join us to tell us all about the winners. So Ashley, where would you like to begin today?
Michael, I think we have to start with the story that's dominating the newspapers in Hong Kong right now. It's the continuing saga of the murder of Abby Choi. Eric Wilson, who is a veteran reporter currently based in Hong Kong, is here to explain. He was previously the editorial director of Tatler Asia Group, as well as a reporter and writer for InStyle, The New York Times, and Women's Wear Daily. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you.
So 2 years ago, the murder of Abby Choi rocked Hong Kong and, in fact, the international press. It became a huge story. Take us back and briefly describe exactly how it happened.
Well, it was February 24th, 2023, late in the evening. News reports started coming in that the police had found parts of a body in a remote village house in the north of Hong Kong. They knew right away that the victim was a fairly well-known aspiring influencer in Hong Kong named Abby Choi, who had been going out to a lot of glamorous parties over recent years and had a high profile on Instagram. But the way that she was killed was so horrific. She was chopped into pieces and parts of her body were cooked into a soup with carrots and radishes, as the police noted that night, that it caught everyone's attention. And of course, the blame immediately turned to her ex-husband, who she'd been having a property dispute with over an apartment that she had paid for, that he and his family were living in. And as the details kept coming, it just became more and more strange. It was like a soap opera in one night. We found out that his entire family was involved in some way in allegedly plotting the murder. They have not yet been tried. So her ex-husband, his brother, his father were all arrested and charged with murder. His mother was charged with obstruction of justice because she had been misleading the police about where he had been in the past.
So Choi was married twice, right? She had two children with her first husband and two with her second. But it's pretty clear that her first husband was a really bad guy, but now it seems like we're just finding out exactly how bad he was.
It's like an onion that keeps peeling back layers, and it smells worse every time that you look at the news. We found out fairly shortly after the murders that Alex Kwong, the ex-husband, had been arrested once before, but what we didn't know was that he had never been held accountable for his crimes. It turns out in 2015, so 8 years before the murder, he had been arrested for a series of thefts, basically stemming from an investment scheme that he had proposed to several men he met online using a dating app, and you can infer what that might mean, in which he convinced these men to buy gold and jewelry, which he was going to then take to the mainland to sell at a higher price once the gold market rebounded. But of course, he just immediately ghosted these men and took their jewelry and was accused of having basically run a kind of an investment scheme. And so he was charged with 6 or 7 counts of theft at that time. But then he left Hong Kong. While he was on bail, he just left the city and was never found again in all that time. His court date was scheduled for that fall, but when he obviously didn't show up for it, the police put out another warrant for his arrest, and they looked for him for some time, but his mother kept saying she'd never heard from him. And he hadn't apparently come back into Hong Kong through any legal channel in all that time. Several people who have since testified in various court trials or have talked to the press have noted that he was, in fact, back in Hong Kong numerous times since 2019. So even though he'd been out on bail and had escaped from Hong Kong, he was never held accountable for these earlier crimes that happened while he was married to Abby Choi.
I mean, Eric, Hong Kong is not known for having especially lax laws at the border. I mean, how do we imagine that he was able to get back and forth? Are there any conspiracy theories around this, or do we have any evidence that would support one of them?
Well, there are lots of conspiracy theories around the entire case, but specifically regarding coming back and forth and through Hong Kong, which is not a simple matter for anybody without the proper documentation. It's very well regulated and very automated, in fact, very modern, the border process almost anywhere where you come in and out of the city. But there's 2 or 3 theories that you could look at. Number one is what they call a boat-to-boat transfer. And if you've ever watched a K-pop drama, you've probably seen this, where you're taken out into a boat into international waters, picked up by another boat that brings you back into another place where you wouldn't actually go through customs. And in fact, that's what he was trying to do when he tried to escape from Hong Kong after Abby Choi's murder. He had negotiated with a yacht rental agent to have a boat pick him up at a kind of a remote pier in the northern part of Hong Kong to take him out to waters where he would then go be picked up by another boat and taken to Macau. The problem with that being a regular activity is that it's quite complicated, very expensive, and very dangerous, very risky. So it's unlikely he was doing that quite frequently. A second possibility, because when he was finally arrested in 2023, the day after the body was found, when he was trying to make his escape, among his personal effects, they found his brother's passport and Chinese driver's license, which could mean he was for some time using his brother's identity coming back and forth. The third option, which of course, this is where you really get into the conspiracy theories, is whether or not he was bribing someone higher up in the customs process or involved with any type of criminal element that could have been moving groups of people back and forth from the city, which, you know, there are still multiple examples of that happening in the news all the time.
This topic is once again dominating the headlines in Hong Kong because of a recent trial. Tell us about what's going on now. Bring us up to speed.
In the months after the murder happened, 6 people were ultimately charged in the crime. There was the ex-husband, his brother and father, who were the 3 charged with murder. Their trial has not yet happened, and it's just moved to the high court this year, so hopefully we'll know soon when that's going to actually go to court. But 2 other trials did happen this year related to the other 3 people who were implicated in the crime. His mother, Jenny Lee, who was charged with obstruction for having misled the authorities about where Alex was when they were starting their investigation. And the other 2 were the yacht rental agent he had approached, as well as a woman who was a friend of his, of the yacht rental agents, who had also helped kind of facilitate that escape plan. So the 2 accomplices on the escape plan were tried in February of this year. Earlier this summer, they were found guilty, each sentenced to 6 months in prison. And the second trial was of his mother, which happened in July. Her verdict came out on Tuesday, and she was found guilty of obstruction as well for her role. Her sentence will be later this fall, but we're still awaiting the main trial at this point.
Eric, do investigators have a clear motive for this in their mind?
The most obvious motive, and what they even said on the day that her body was found, was that there was a massive dispute happening between her family and her ex-husband's family over the fate of this apartment that she had supposedly bought for them to live in after the divorce and now wanted to sell because the Hong Kong property market was tanking. It was a $9.3 million apartment, which is startling, and when you think about why she would have bought this apartment for her ex-husband's family to live in. But you do have to understand this is Hong Kong, where strange things do happen like this. The police believe it was this dispute over the apartment that led to the plot to ultimately kill her.
You know, Eric, Is there a sense of outrage? Like, what's sort of the mood in Hong Kong right now around this case? How are people reacting to this and these revelations?
You know, Hong Kong has one of the most pronounced disparities between the wealthy and the poor. And this is actually really an interesting aspect of the story, is it is the story of a rich family and a financially struggling family and the different experiences they've had in Hong Kong. So I think that's one of the reasons why it's really struck a nerve in the city, you know, seeing this disparity in their different existence and why the financially struggling family might have been so jealous of what was happening with this much richer family that they would then, you know, want what she had and maybe have felt entitled to the same kind of things that she was getting in her life. This kind of sudden going off to Paris couture fashion shows and going to incredible parties while they were struggling to make ends meet, that may have really triggered that kind of jealousy. And I feel like that's part of the Hong Kong story. It's one of the things about Hong Kong that when people hear this story, they will often say, could only be in Hong Kong.
Well, Eric, thank you so much. Your reporting is riveting, and we really appreciate you taking the time to make sense of this all for us.
I'm still trying. Thank you.
Well, we have another completely intriguing character in the issue this week, courtesy of our colleague Clara Malo, who's the investigations editor here at Airmail. She's here to tell us how a student from the Bay Area managed to trick her way into Yale University, posing as a small town girl from North Dakota. Welcome, Clara.
Thanks for having me.
So your story in the issue takes us inside one of these topics we can't get enough of, which is the impossibility of college admissions these days. You uncovered a student who faked her way into Yale. First of all, how did the story even come to light?
Yeah, so the Yale Daily News, which is the, you know, the school newspaper, published a story about a student who went by Katarina Lin, who was accused of like having a sex slave and was removed from campus by police last Friday. And so the story kind of started with that piece of investigation. But I guess there was a dorm and this girl, Katarina, you know, as we call her, her suite mates were really suspicious and ended up going through her things and found a real ID that didn't align with the information that she had presented to the school to gain acceptance.
So what lengths did she go to earn admission to Yale? What do we know about her life before she arrived?
It's really impressive. She essentially decided halfway through her sophomore year of high school that Yale wasn't in the cards for her. She was an Asian student in California, and she thought it was just going to be too difficult. And so instead of devoting her time to her studies, she devoted it into learning all these new tricks and skills to essentially create an entirely fake persona that would trick Yale. And, you know, so she was from a small oil town in North Dakota. Her address was a motel there. She had a North Dakota cell phone number. She created a transcript from scratch, teacher recommendations from scratch, changed her name. And with me, she was a little bit cagey about exactly how she did certain things. You know, how do you trick Yale into this? Because she said she didn't want copycats and she had created her own methods that she didn't want, you know, to enter the public knowledge.
But it was super impressive. I mean, as you report in your story, supposedly, if we're to believe her, she said the admissions person who she later contacted her and said hers was the most impressive application of the entire student body that year, right?
Yeah, exactly. And she felt so bad. She was like, I don't want to crush his dreams. She had basically crafted the perfect application. You know, she listened to the Yale admissions podcast. She read books. Like, she put a lot of time and energy into making sure that her application, one, raised no red flags about her identity, and two, would gain her acceptance.
She said she wanted to do this because she thought, like, obviously, I'm an Asian student from California. That kind of box is already checked. So she had to swerve over and create something that no one had ever seen before, right?
Yeah, I would love to see the actual application. I haven't been able to get my hands on it, but say what you will about the ethics of what she did. She's got to be smart because I would imagine that that is no easy feat. And it doesn't sound like she had any help from anyone.
As I'm reading this story, it's so incredulous for so many reasons. But the first is that she got through Yale in the first place. I mean, like, are they not doing basic identity checks on their applicants? I mean, I feel like just to put my kids into nursery school in New York City, you had to send their passports and their birth certificates and all this information. Like, how did she get through those filters?
Yeah, well, that's part of the thing she's really cagey about, because clearly something she did worked, and I would have to assume people try this and it usually doesn't work. I will say that part of the North Dakota idea is that they don't have a system that is digitized. So, you know, usually she said to me, for instance, that from her California high school, it wouldn't have worked because they use one platform. And I remember this from when I applied. And that platform is linked with the Yale platform. Like, they use the same kind of software, I guess. And so she needed to pick somewhere that was rural enough and didn't have those resources. So she was doing things and, you know, the school would say, oh, I guess that's just how they do it in this tiny town we've never heard of 2,000 people. And so I think that gave her a little bit more leeway than if you had been applying from like New York or DC or, you know, somewhere else.
I mean, Clara, another mystifying fact about this story is that she's talking to you about it. I mean, back in the day, this would have been the end of someone's nascent university career. Like, where is she going to go next? What's the future for her? But do we live in this age of forgiveness where people can do these sorts of insane things and they become kind of internet sensations and therefore recreate a different life for themselves? I mean, what does her future hold?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I would say that she was very hesitant to speak with me and knows that, you know, this is a huge deal in her life and it's going to mean, you know, going a completely different direction. But I think there was that Yale story that painted her like a crazy person, you know, with the BDSM parts. And she honestly, like, as she said to me, I think she was like, I think people think I'm a Chinese spy. And so I think this was her way of almost clearing her name, if we can call it that, you know, saying what's rumor and what she actually did do. And then I don't think we're going to know of any Katarina Linz anymore. You know, like, I think she's going to start again.
Hey, I mean, if Anna Delvey could have a comeback, I have faith in her as well.
I agree. I'm team Katarina.
I would think if I were like the CIA or, you know, the NSA, just like, this is someone who clearly can hack a system. Give her a job, you know, as an intelligence officer right now. And who needs college?
Yeah, I know. I keep thinking of that line in Clueless where the dad says, like, honey, I wouldn't even be more proud of you if they were real grades, when she like negotiated her way up to A's, because this is much more work, more original, and definitely more dicey than like what I did to get to Yale. So I was saying, I feel like they should just like let her stay.
I mean, and by the way, you know, to actually your point, like, if she's going to apply for college again, write about something in your personal essay that you have, like, you know, like, hey, I've got a story for you now. Imagine this. I was so desperate. I created this false persona, but I've learned my lesson. And so please let me in now.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, Clara, thank you so much. Great story. And we look forward to the next.
Thanks so much.
If you're a creative who finds inspiration in unexpected connections, who sees a design and immediately wonders about its origins, Claude gets that curiosity. Whether you're developing concepts, researching visual trends, or exploring how ideas move between industries, Claude helps you follow those creative rabbit holes that lead to breakthrough insights. Try Claude for free at claude.ai/morningmeeting and see why the world's best problem solvers choose Claude as their thinking partner.
Well, there are plenty of credible talents in the world, and we've got quite a few of them involved in the new Tom Wolfe Prize for Fiction and Reportage, which is presented by Mont Blanc. And it's something that has been a big topic of conversation here at Airmail. And this week, the winners will be shared with the world. Julia Vitale, our deputy managing editor, is here with Alexandra Wolf Schiff, a journalist as well as the daughter of Tom Wolfe, to explain how it all came together. Welcome, Julia and Alexandra.
Thank you.
Okay, Julia, so Airmail has been around now for 6.5 years. And finally, at long last, we have a literary prize. So Michael and I are obviously going to be entering this next year, but are we even eligible? Like, what are the rules? Like, what's the process? Tell us everything we need to know.
Yes. So the idea behind these literary prizes was to kind of pinpoint an emerging writer in the fiction and reportage categories that we felt like was doing amazing work, not really getting the credit that they deserve. And when we started thinking more about the prizes and kind of the footprint that we wanted to leave, we thought it would be nice to kind of associate the prize with a titan of literature. And obviously, it was difficult to find someone who was both a master in fiction and nonfiction until we thought of Tom Wolfe, and then it was the easiest thing.
We have Alexander here, who obviously is carrying the torch in so many ways. But Alexander, how did you get involved in this? And tell us a little bit about, you know, some of the contestants and the committee and the team that made this all happen.
Well, it was really Airmail's team. And Graydon Carter reached out to my mother and my brother and I and asked if this is something that we would be excited about. And of course we were, because we've always been huge fans, and Dad and my mom were great friends of Graydon's. And so we were very excited about it from the beginning. And I guess then, Julia, you all put together a team of judges and asked if I would want to join. And I was flattered that you wanted me to join, because although I admire my father, I am not my father. And I wish I was. So it was a lot of fun to be on the committee to help choose the winners of these prizes.
Okay, so Julia, when Michael and I submit our work next year, like, who do we need for the prize?
It's funny you asked that. When we were putting it together, this committee, people are busy, more busy than ever these days. And I really was expecting for it to kind of be like so-and-so kind of agreeing to put their name on the prize. And that was it. But what I think I was so pleasantly surprised by, and Alexandra, you might also agree, is how involved certain committee members were, both in terms of reading everything possible and coming with really, really insightful commentary that made the whole kind of narrowing down process and ultimately deciding on a winner that much more meaningful. So we had people like Lena Dunham, who's obviously busy filming her show, Lisa Tadeo, who's busy adapting her books into shows, and a few other really standout committee members who made this whole process, I think, that much better.
Let's talk about our winners. Who do we start with?
So for fiction, we went with Vincenzo Latronico.
Good accent. Wow.
Thank you. One of the few criteria for our prize, we left a very open ending in just like emerging writers, no age limit, but tried to skew on the younger side. One of the few criteria was for their work to be available in English. And Vincenzo has written several books, but the first one to be translated in English was his novel Perfection, which came out earlier this year and is about an expat millennial couple living in Berlin. And we were blown away by it. We thought it was Wolfian in its observations and just so good at capturing a generation and its preoccupations. We considered a lot of names for this prize, but I think he was a almost unanimous winner with the committee. And on the nonfiction side, we're equally excited about Megan Dawn, who has been a writer for quite some time, but we wanted to give her the credit that she deserved. And Alexandra, you had actually a really good way of putting kind of her work and how you interpreted it.
I guess I love the idea of having a fiction and nonfiction prize, both of them named after my father, because he loved to sort of combine both. He would put it much more elegantly, I'm sure, but he always tried to make his fiction sound like it was true, because he'd always thought truth is stranger than fiction. And then he tried to make nonfiction sound like a novel. And when I read Megan Dom's book, that's exactly how I felt. I can't put words in my father's mouth, but when I read it, it just felt like it was in that vein of sort of, you know, you're like, this is nonfiction, are you sure? And it sort of had that courage and bravery of really not caring what other people thought. And I feel like my father, when I think of him, I think of that quality. He'd always say, like, don't think about what quote unquote they think when you're writing something, to such an extent that, I mean, when I was reading some of her essays, I remembered, you know, calling him when I was younger, like from some, you know, horrible party or like, you know, some vacation where I wanted to like jump back on the plane, and him just looking at me and saying, or talking to me on the phone and saying, you know, take notes. Like he made the personal sort of into like reportage, and he made the reportage into something personal. And that's why I just love the idea of these prizes, awarding writers that really sort of embrace that idea without knowing that he did too. But I mean, just sort of on their own.
Alexander, which book of Megan's were you talking about? Was it?
Oh, The Catastrophe Hour.
So take us inside some of these committee meetings. Like, we really want to hear about who was passionate about what and who got really opinionated. You guys, this is a safe space. You can spill the dirt.
Isn't it classified? Sorry, no, I'm kidding. I thought people's comments were really specific, and I don't want to say what other people thought, I guess, but one of the people that I was totally obsessed with that didn't win, sadly, but I like love Bianca. I mean, I loved a lot of them, but the one that I feel like I can share out that I was emphatically excited about as well as these two, I loved Bianca Bosker. Like, I thought Cork Dork was so funny. I don't know, Julia, do you remember? I don't know what I can say what other people thought. I feel like I don't want to spill the beans, but maybe you can.
I'll say that I thought it was really funny that all of the committee members before our meeting to kind of discuss nominees put together a list of nominees, and Lisa Tadeo's suggested winner for the reportage category was Olivia Nuzzi. And I loved that idea and the fact that she just put in that wild card. And then I also just thought it was nice, like Lisa got on to this Zoom and was just like, I sit in Zooms all day talking about like films or TV that may or may not get made, and to actually be in a Zoom talking about something as exciting as new literature is just a breath of fresh air. And I love that.
Yeah.
Well, Julia Alexandra, I mean, after going through this process and immersing yourselves in so much talent, does it have you feeling hopeful about the state of literary America?
I was so hopeful because I'm embarrassed to say this, but so many of the people who were nominated, I had never read before any of their books or anything. I mean, a lot of the people I'd heard about, and especially there are a couple of New York Times writers and other kind of journalists who are nominated who I'd read articles they'd written, but I'd never gone through so many of their stories. I don't know. I just learned so much about these subcultures that I normally wouldn't have learned about in terms of the nonfiction nominees. And then in terms of the fiction nominees, this is why this award is such a good idea, because you sort of don't always hear about some of these writers who would be nominated by this group of people. I mean, whenever I decide on a new book, I sort of just look at the bestseller list, or I see what my friends would say. But I mean, this is just such an interesting group. I don't get to call Wes Anderson and say, who do you think is good to read, or any of these people. And so just seeing their suggestions put into a list like this and sort of checking out sort of emerging talent was pretty exciting. So I feel very positive on things.
Yeah. And I would say, to Alexandra's point, like, this list was really born out of a desire to kind of bring people and communities together. It's just, I feel like even like in the time when your dad was writing his work, Alexandra, it was just like when a great book was published, everyone was talking about it, and that was that. And now, like, there are great books that get published and whole kind of swaths of the population will never even hear about them. So I think this was kind of our like small effort to bring people together with this goal of reading great books and being aligned on them. And I think like the excitement was palpable just like from everyone involved. Like, we didn't just get nominee submissions from the committee itself. We also got them from readers of Airmail and the publishing world, and just they kind of came from all corners, and that was really exciting to see.
My mom and I, we always talk about like what dad would have wanted his legacy to be, or what, you know, I mean, what, like, we were like, just, would he want his clothes like hung in a museum, or like, what do you want? And not that this is like our choice really, but I kind of always thought like something that would encourage people to report. Like, he's always about reporting and like leaving your desk and getting out of the office and seeing the world. And I kind of feel like a prize like this is kind of like the best thing that, you know, I mean, I can't put words in his mouth, but I mean, just this idea of encouraging reporting in both fiction and nonfiction, I think is something he always wanted to do. I mean, he took him a decade to write every single book, so he wasn't about to like teach a reporting class on the side, but he would be very happy that Airmail encouraged it. So,
well, Julia Alexandra, thank you so much and congratulations. This is an amazing project and thank you guys for making it happen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's only one place to discover a global snapshot of the current cultural scene: Airmail's Arts Intel Report. Our international research tool for what to do and where and when to do it is user-friendly, continuously updated, and meticulously curated. Arts Intel is handy at home, on the road, and when you're planning your next trip. It also includes indispensable lists of restaurants and hotels in key cities around the world, recommended by our well-traveled experts. Explore Arts Intel at airmail.news/arts-intel, and be sure to sign up for our Week in Culture newsletter, which is published every Wednesday afternoon at airmail.news/WIC. I'm Chris Garrett, Airmail Deputy Editor, and I never leave home without it. Bon voyage.
On that note, Michael, I know you've got your reading list, but what do you have that you can recommend to me?
It's something that's going to be on PBS, of all things, this weekend, but it's coming from the UK. You may have seen it where it ran earlier this year. Have you seen this show? It's a two-part series. It's called Brian and Maggie.
I have not.
So, you know, I think we all know Frost Nixon, which was the classic recreation of that sit down between Frost and Nixon. This one is a two-parter. It's billed as a docuseries, and it was directed by Stephen Frears, who does great work. And it stars Steve Coogan as a Labour MP turned journalist, Brian Walden, and then Harriet Walter, who you may remember from Succession, who played the first wife, and she plays Margaret Thatcher. And it sort of revolves around an interview they did in 1989. They were longtime friends. And then how their friendship kind of came to tatters after this interview that they did in the UK. So it's going to show up on PBS this weekend on Sunday night if you all want to watch it. I haven't seen it, I have to admit, but I've seen the trailers. Super intrigued by it. I love the work of Steve Coogan and love the work of Stephen Frears. And like I say, anything that sort of travels in the footsteps of Frost Nixon, I'm sure it's got to be pretty great. And it's called Brian and Maggie. And you, my dear?
Well, Michael, you know I love a love story. And so I just started a really wonderful new novel. It's called Heart the Lover, and it's by Lily King. And it just came out here in the UK. I think it just came out in the US as well, roughly around the same time. But it tells the story of a successful novelist who's very happily married, but she can't help but take a look back at her first love. And it comes to revisit her in all sorts of interesting ways. And it kind of threatens to upend the life that she's currently living. Anyway, I haven't finished it yet, but I find it really immersive because, you know, who doesn't love a love story? So it's called Heart the Lover by Lily King, and it just came out. That's a wrap on today's morning meeting brought to you by Claude. If you're someone who can't help but ask, where did this idea really come from? Or what if we trace this influence back further? Try Claude. It's the AI that feeds your curiosity rather than rushing you to conclusions. Try Claude for free at claude.ai/morning meeting. All right. We wish you all a wonderful weekend. Thank you so much for joining us. Michael, will you please read us out?
Yeah, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Anthropic, as well. Morning Meeting is produced by Airplay Productions and edited by Jesse Cannon. Our co-editors are Graydon Carter and Alexander Stanley. Our chief operating officer is Bill Keenan, and our deputies are Ashley Baker, Chris Garrett, Nathan King, Julie Vitale, and Ash Carter. Our CMO is Emily Davis. And our music supervisor is Randall Poster. The theme music is The Cute Monster by the Buddy Collette Quintet. A new edition of Airmail is published every Saturday, so please subscribe and enjoy all of our stories on airmail.news, which we update every day. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at Airmail Weekly. We'll be back here next Saturday with another edition of Morning Meeting, but in the meantime, be sure to subscribe to Spotify or Apple Music. But most of all, thank you again for joining us.